This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Last month, my guest made a confession where everyone could see, in the New York Times Magazine. In his article, journalist Jose Antonio Vargas revealed that he is an undocumented immigrant. This was a big surprise since he's hardly lived his life in the shadows. He shared a Pulitzer Prize when he was a reporter for the Washington Post and went on to write for the Huffington Post and to profile Mark Zuckerberg in the New Yorker. His mother sent him from the Philippines to live with his grandparents in the U.S. when he was 12, in 1993, and they had led him to believe he was a legitimate U.S. resident. But when he was 16, he stumbled on the truth. His green card was fake, and his family had lied to him. When he found that out, he kept it secret. He illegally obtained a driver's license. He lied about his status on some job application forms. We're going to talk about why he decided to go public and what the consequences might be. Vargas has started a new activist group called Define American with the mission of changing the conversation about immigration. Jose Antonio Vargas, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me.
So have you heard from any immigration authorities since you revealed that you are undocumented?
No, I have not. My lawyers and I have not heard from anybody. We're just kind of waiting. You know, when I decided to do this, I had to get myself into a place where I just have to be prepared for anything and everything. So that's kind of where I'm at.
So I guess you got your lawyers before you decided to come out as undocumented.
Well, I treated it like a big story that I was working on. And so I just interviewed and talked to a lot of people. And I mean, mind you, if the lawyers had it their way, I would not have written what I wrote in the first place. It was really interesting. You know, 30 minutes before the magazine was going to press, I was on the phone with a lawyer, with one of the lawyers who had been advising me, actually saying, you know, take that word out. And I wasn't going to do that just because I really wanted to write the piece in such a way that, you know, I'm just one person who had to go through what I had to go through. And a lot of people are going through the exact same thing.
So how old are you now?
I'm 30. I turned 30 in February.
So why did you decide to come out as undocumented now? Did something change in your life? Was there a last straw? Was there a turning point?
I mean, last year, when I got the driver's license in Oregon in 2003, it expired. The license lasted me for 8 full years. It expired on my 30th birthday, which was February of this year, February 3rd of this year. So that was always a kind of a deadline in my head. Like, okay, I had 8 years. Maybe the laws are going to be fixed by then, and that Washington is going to come up with a solution in terms of, you know, this country's immigration problem.
Let me just stop you here. And a driver's license is important not only because it allows you to drive, but because it's your ID.
I needed that license to not just drive, but to get around this country. And that was my piece. You know, I didn't have a passport, never tried to get one. I never voted. The irony, of course, is I spent 2 years traveling for the Washington Post covering the presidential campaign, and I couldn't vote in the race that I was covering. And back to your point about why the time now, of course, having that 8-year deadline in my head and the fact that it was approaching. And last year for me was kind of the peak of my career. You know, like I had profiled Mark Zuckerberg, the Facebook founder for The New Yorker. Everybody wanted to talk to him, and I landed the interview. I had a film that was based on stories that I did for the Washington Post turned into a documentary that was, you know, a director and a producer wanted to turn into a documentary. And the entire time that I was kind of experiencing this career high, all I kept thinking in my head was, this license is going to expire. What am I going to do? And I think I started reading and watching a lot of the stories, a lot of the Dream Act activists. You know, I remember particularly reading about, you know, four students from Florida who walked from Florida to Washington, D.C., 1,500 miles to lobby for the Dream Act. And I'm sitting in my apartment in Manhattan thinking, I was in their shoes just 7 years ago. I had to do something. And the final straw was on December 18th. That's when the Dream Act failed in the Senate. I said to myself, I took a long walk to the Brooklyn Bridge and back, listened to a lot of Beyonce and a lot of Joni Mitchell and a lot of Rachmaninoff. And somehow I just went home and I said, okay, this is what I'm going to do. So the story was published online on June 22nd. Apparently it was the most shared article on Google for like an entire week. And it just got around, you know, undocumented immigrant, which is not necessarily a sexy phrase, was a trending topic on Twitter. We had accomplished the goal of making sure that people think about immigration in a different way. And now it's just making sure that we sustain, you know, again, that this is not just about my story. This is about stories of countless, you know, not just, of course, young Americans, but undocumented immigrants in this country and what we have to do to survive.
So, even though your story, My Life as an Undocumented Immigrant, was Googled a lot and was not everybody has heard the story. So let's talk a little about what happened to you. In 1993, when you were 12, your mother sent you from the Philippines to the United States to live with your grandparents who were here legally.
Yes, both were legal, yeah.
What did she tell you about why she was sending you to the U.S.?
You know, being in the Philippines, it was always somehow communicated to me when I was young that my future was in America. I just never knew when it was going to come or what that even meant. I mean, all I knew was that I woke up one morning and my suitcase was packed and there was a cab outside and there I am at the airport and my mom is saying goodbye.
Why didn't she come with you?
Well, at that point, that wasn't really explained to me. But basically, when I got to the airport, I was introduced to a man who they, you know, told me was my uncle. I'd never met this man. And he was the one that actually escorted me on the plane. And then I would find out later on when I discovered, you know, when I was 16, that I was undocumented, that he was actually a coyote that my grandfather had paid $4,500 to. You know, my grandfather was a security guard. He probably made no more than $9 an hour his entire life. And they paid this coyote to get me here. And at that point, my mother wanted to get here, getting a visa, but she was denied 3 times. So my mother, I haven't seen my mother since I was 12, actually since I left that morning in the airport. But I didn't find out, you know, I got to America when I was 12. And then 4 years after that, you know, like every 16-year-old, I wanted to get my driver's permit. So I didn't tell my grandparents. I just took my bike and I went to the DMV and I sat there and the woman called me into the booth. And I show her my green card, which is kind of proof of residency. I just showed it to her and I remember she looked at it, this woman, she flipped it around and she like lowered her voice and looked at me and said, "This is fake. Don't come back here again." And I remember riding my bike home thinking, I was angry, I was confused. I thought maybe she was lying, but why would she lie? So then I confronted my grandfather. You know, when I got home, he was in the garage actually cutting coupons. I confronted him and he confirmed it. And that was when, you know, in many ways, that was kind of the beginning of my reporting career, I guess. Like, I was just really curious, you know, how could this have happened? And how come no one told me? And at that point, I'd been in America for 4 years. I loved this country. And I did not want to have the jobs that my grandfather wanted me to have. He just thought, you know, stay under the radar, maybe work at a flea market, maybe be a busboy at a restaurant, maybe have one of those under-the-table jobs. And I didn't want that for myself.
What did you want?
You know, I was really lucky. I mean, a year after that, my English teacher, my sophomore English teacher, Mrs. Dewar, introduced me to journalism. I didn't know what journalism was. She just said that I asked a lot of questions, and so she said I should go to this journalism camp at San Francisco State University. It was for free, and so I went, and I was fascinated by it. I remember actually one of my first ever interviews, if not the first ever, was with a man named Ron Unz. Does that ring a bell? Ron Unz.
No.
He authored a bill called Proposition 227, which was all about anti-bilingual education, and he was explaining to me the importance of speaking English. And I remember, you know, I spoke Tagalog, which is the language in the Philippines. You know, English was my second language, and I completely agreed with this man. I was sitting there thinking, he's right, you know, immigrants in this country must learn English. And I agreed with the guy. I didn't think I was going to agree with him because I thought he was quote-unquote anti-immigrant. But I just love that. I love that I could talk to people who didn't agree with me, or I love talking to people who changed my mind.
You had learned, after you confronted your grandfather with the fake green card, you had learned that he had gotten forged papers for you.
Yeah.
You revealed that in your New York Times Magazine article a few weeks ago. Your grandfather is no longer alive. Would you have revealed that if he was alive, or would you have not written that to protect him?
That's a really good question. You know, I don't know. I think there was a period in time when I was younger, and you know, I guess this is what happens when you're young, you're too immature and you can't think beyond yourself. I was so mad at them. I was so mad at my grandfather. I was so mad at my mother. I was so mad at them for putting me in the position that I just found myself in. And then, of course, I got older, and I realized the sacrifices that they've made, and I realized why they did what they did. And I've always wanted to protect them. You know, even the people in the piece, every name in the piece that was mentioned, meaning my choir teacher, my high school principal, my high school superintendent, the guy who ended up actually sending me to college through a scholarship, all of them, before I used their names, I cleared it with every single one of them more than twice, because I didn't want to endanger them. You know, I didn't want to drag them into this mess that I'm in. But to my own surprise, they said, no, please, you know, include me. I want to be included. As for my grandfather, you know, I'm not sure. I mean, I certainly would have asked for his permission. He thought he was doing the best thing for me. Now, mind you, he and I, ever since I told him, you know, when I was a junior in high school that I'm gay, our relationship just kind of changed. Because, I mean, his solution for me, the plan was work under the table jobs, marry a woman, and get a green card. Well, when I was a junior in high school, this was right around after Matthew Shepard, you know, I'm sure you remember Matthew Shepard mm-hmm. case when he yep. was, you know, hung in that fence and he died. I mean, that was really, I think for my generation, that's a big, big kind of memory for us, for a lot of closeted kids back then. After that happened, I just came out. So after that happened, my grandfather was really disappointed in me because, you know, I basically was not going by his plan. And I remember my reasoning to him was, you know, I'm not going to tell another lie. It's one thing to live with this kind of lie, to being an undocumented immigrant. It was a whole other thing to marry a woman to get a green card. I was not going to do that.
Okay, so you ruled out a green card marriage. You came out as gay because you didn't want to live a lie. Yet you were forced to lie about a lot of things just in order to stay here and be employed here and have a driver's license. But you're right, you convinced yourself that if you worked enough and achieved enough, you would be rewarded with citizenship. Why did you think that? I mean, you know...
Doesn't it sound like something like a 19 and 18-year-old would actually think? I remember actually thinking to myself. And, you know, this is where journalism comes in, right? I remember once when I was younger, I spent a lot of time in public libraries because I wanted to really read, you know? Like, really read. I mean, like, New Yorker read. Like, read long things. And I remember a quote about journalism being the first draft of history. And I remember thinking to myself, what if I write all these stories? Like, how can people say I don't exist? And, you know, this was around the time that, you know, I grew up in California and right around Proposition 187, you know, kind of the sting of that.
What was Proposition 187?
187 was basically, in many circles, called as the anti-immigration bill. You know, undocumented immigrants couldn't get social services, right? Or this was the kind of time in which some kids actually went to school with their green cards because they were afraid that teachers were going to ask for their green cards to make sure that they're supposed to be in this country. That's the kind of law that's in many ways a precursor to what we're seeing in Alabama and in Georgia and Arizona.
Right? As you mentioned, that bill passed, but it was ruled unconstitutional.
It was ruled unconstitutional in Georgia, yeah. But whenever I heard the term illegal alien, once I knew that I was undocumented, I knew that I'm not illegal as a human being and I'm not an alien. And somehow journalism, you know, seeing my name on, you know, in print, interviewing Americans, writing in English, covering things happening in America, somehow it made me feel like, okay, you know, I'm contributing. I'm one of you. So I convinced myself that I actually thought if I wrote enough articles, if I got to cover like a presidential campaign or something, or maybe if I started writing for this thing called The New Yorker, because I remember picking up The New Yorker and not being able to actually get through it. I actually thought to myself that that would be success and somehow success was going to buy me citizenship, that I was going to get it because I deserved it. And then, of course, that's not the truth. And of course, last year, when I did end up writing for The New Yorker, and I was still in the same spot.
You know, I think a lot of people have been basically making this comment that you were working as a journalist, which is about uncovering the truth,
yes,
yet you
yes.
were telling fundamental lies about yourself. So was journalism, therefore, the wrong profession for you? Were you betraying your profession by not being honest about yourself?
I completely understand that question, and I completely, of course, have read some of the criticism about this. And the question that I've always had is, what would they have done if they were in my shoes? And I think kind of this idea of almost like a false equivalency, you know, I had to lie to work, to be in those newsrooms. Now, granted, getting hired onto the San Francisco Chronicle or the Washington Post or the Huffington Post are not easy things. Let's leave immigration out of it. Just getting hired onto those staffs and onto those newsrooms or writing for the New Yorker, those are not easy things. But I wanted to be in those newsrooms. And to be in those newsrooms, I had to lie about who I was. But the work, the journalism, you know, I've written maybe 650 articles since I was 17 years old. No one has kind of questioned not just the balance or the, you know, kind of the work. And I think in many ways, I even beat myself up so much. I'm one of those people, I've had maybe 8 corrections my entire career, and most of them are like spelling related. I am vigilant when it comes to my journalism.
When you were working at the Washington Post, you write about this in your New York Times article. When you were working at the Washington Post, you told your editor, Peter Pearl, about your predicament, that you were undocumented.
Yes, yes.
And so now he's exposed?
By the way, I mean, back to my earlier point about this.
Yeah.
I went back and forth with Peter on this. Because I said to him, you know, I don't need to include you in this piece. My instinct was to protect him. And I'm so sorry that I had to put him in that spot. I remember when I first told him, you know, that afternoon in the park.
Why did you tell him?
I told him because, you know, it was one thing for me to be working at the San Francisco Chronicle and being kind of among my support network, right? I was in the Bay Area, and that's where everybody, my grandparents were there, my principal, my superintendent, my support system was there. I didn't know anybody in Washington, D.C. And I get here, you know, I got here summer of 2004. I was so excited. I think I got here 2 days after I graduated from college. And then I was here for a few months, and I started thinking, this is really crazy. Like, what if anybody found out? And it was kind of starting to show just how stressed out I was. I think some editors in the newsroom, I remember a woman was asking me why I always look so stressed out. She said that I always look so anxious, you know, that I always looked that I was worried about my job. And I remember going back to my desk and like, Peter, I actually wrote him an email, Peter, you know, we need to go out for coffee. And thank God he agreed. And so we went out for coffee, and that's when I told him. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, I didn't know how he was going. I really didn't know what he was going to say or how he was going to react. All I knew is that I needed to tell somebody, and I trusted Peter more than anybody else in the newsroom. You know, he had been nice to me. He had been a mentor when I was just an intern, just the previous summer before. So I told him. And I remember I realized telling him what an uncomfortable position I had put him in. So I apologized for that. And what surprised me was his response. It was like the humanity in his response. I mean, it still kills me to this day. How this man could just look at me and say, you know, this is our problem now. I'm going to help you out. It's going to be okay. You know? You know, he knew that if he would have told the top editors at the Washington Post that I would have been in trouble. You know, I might have been deported. They would have had to fire me. And he thought that I was a promising journalist, that he didn't want to put me in that situation.
So this is an interesting example of how telling the truth to anybody potentially endangers them.
Yeah.
And that might be more so true now because, didn't Alabama just pass a law that, harboring law? Why don't you explain the law and how would that have affected the predicament of people who you told your status to?
You know, I mean, laws are getting passed in states like Alabama that basically would punish American citizens who are, quote unquote, harboring undocumented people. You know, since the federal government hasn't been able to muster or to get comprehensive immigration reform passed, states are taking it upon themselves to police and to enforce laws.
So if the law stays as it is now, if immigration law stays as it is now, What are your options?
That's actually what we're figuring out right now.
We being you and your lawyers?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I have a team of, you know, lawyers who are helping me out figure out what the options are. But in the meantime, you know, this is what, as I said in the essay, you know, I had gotten a second driver's license. And that would have bought me 5 years. It would have given me 5 years to keep living the way I was living. You know, I could have continued on writing magazine articles and working for a news organization. But I decided that I don't want that kind of life anymore. And not just for me, but for thousands, you know, for what, 11 million undocumented people in this country.
Were you afraid that you were pushing your luck too, that at some point you were going to be found out and better to just expose it yourself than
there was a part of that. I mean, people have asked me, you know, was somebody threatening to out you? Like, no. No one was threatening to out me. I mean, I decided to come forward with it. I just didn't want this kind of life anymore. And whatever it is that I'm going through, a lot of other people are going through it.
So if you could just give us like a short version of what the path to citizenship would be for someone who arrived in the United States from another country, undocumented, at the age of 16 or younger. You know, if the DREAM Act passed, and I realize there's been different versions of the DREAM Act, and now there's a House version and a Senate version.
Yes.
But just like what the gist of it is.
The gist of it is, you know, it's basically a conditional path to legalization for somebody who could either go to college, you know, graduating from a four-year college institution or joining the military. Basically, these are the kind of, you know, contributing citizens that we would want in this country, right? But basically, the ones who want to pursue higher education and pursue
or join the military.
Or join the military, yeah, which is a career. But yeah, so this is not just for everyone. I mean, think about how many people in this country don't pursue college education. Right, so these are for undocumented, young undocumented Americans, undocumented immigrants, who would want to pursue college education and be contributing member or the military and be contributing parts of society. That's what it would give. But again, it's conditional. It's not just a blanket quote unquote amnesty, which is often the word that gets thrown around, that it would just be a blanket amnesty for every undocumented immigrant out there. Well, that's just not the truth.
So you've started a new organization called Define American.
Yes.
Which you describe as seeking to change the conversation on immigration reform. Well, what needs to be changed in the conversation, do you think?
It's really more elevating and reframing the conversation, meaning that when people say a path to citizenship, the first word that doesn't come to mind is amnesty. Or when people say illegal immigration, the first thing to come to mind is Latinos, for example. And I think in many ways, what Define American seeks to do is really kind of broaden the conversation around immigration and take it out of the ghetto that it's been in. For example, you know, last year, you know, there's a study just came out of the Immigration Policy Center that said that last year, undocumented immigrants paid $11.2 billion in local and state taxes. A lot of people seem to think, most people in America think that undocumented immigrants just take resources and not give anything back. Well, that's just not the truth. A lot of people seem to think that undocumented immigrants don't want to assimilate to America or don't want to learn English. Well, that's just not the truth. I think everybody can agree that our immigration system, it's broken. We have not told the truth about it. We have not come to the table and say, all right, these are the problems. How do we balance the need for enforcement, border security, enforcement? How do we balance that with actually granting some sort of path to legalization to people who have been here, who are educated here, who could be contributing societies? The fact of the matter is, this country is not going to deport 11 million undocumented immigrants. What are we supposed to do with them? What are we supposed to do with these kids? What are we supposed to do with them?
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jose Antonio Vargas's article, My Life as an Undocumented Immigrant, was published in June in the New York Times Magazine. He founded the new group Define American with the goal of changing the conversation on immigration reform. You'll find a link to the group and to his magazine article on our website, freshair.npr.org. We asked Mark Krikorian for his reaction to Jose Antonio Vargas' story about life as an undocumented immigrant. Krikorian is the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies, a think tank that advocates low immigration and strict enforcement. His books include The New Case Against Immigration, Both Legal and Illegal. Mark Krikorian, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you think should happen to Jose Antonio Vargas now that he's admitted that he's undocumented?
Well, it's not so much that he's undocumented, it's that he's an illegal immigrant. He has fraudulent documents. He came here not as a very young child. I mean, he came here as a child, there's no question, but he came here as with an identity formed as a Filipino. In other words, he came at, what was the age, 12 or something like that. That's still pretty young, clearly. But the moral case that you can make for the DREAM Act, or something like the DREAM Act, and there is a moral case to make for it, really only applies, it seems to me, to people whose identities have been formed here, who have no memory of any other country, who really are, as some of the advocates sometimes put it, Americans in all but paperwork. This doesn't really cover a lot of the people that would be covered under the current version of the DREAM Act, including Mr. Vargas. The man has real abilities and real skills, and he should go home to his country of citizenship, the country he grew up in for most of his childhood.
Do you think the United States should force him to go there?
Sure. I mean, he's an illegal immigrant, so obviously you don't have to arrest the guy. I mean, it's hard for him to hide. He should. You give people like this something called voluntary return. You know, you have to leave in 90 days or in 6 months or something like that. So you pack up your things, you resolve your affairs, and you can go home. I mean, he's got a skill that's clearly usable in much of the world, including the Philippines. They have large numbers of English language media. The man has real skills and real abilities, he ought to use those in his own country.
One of the arguments on the other side is, look at how bright he is, how skilled he is, how articulate he is. Why wouldn't we want him to remain in the United States? Isn't that exactly the kind of talent that we want here?
But see, the argument, it seems to me, the strongest case you can make for something like the DREAM Act, which he's now started an advocacy group to promote. In fact, his New York Times article really was part of his advocacy campaign. It wasn't a kind of spontaneous, bearing of his soul. The strongest argument you can make for something like the DREAM Act, as I said, is for people who prudence suggests we should allow stay because their identities have been formed here. They really are, psychologically speaking, Americans. Because understand that what we're proposing here is an amnesty. We are, in other words, legalizing illegal immigrants at the expense of legal immigrants who did not sneak in or were brought in illegally into the country. And that, it seems to me, that's a pretty high bar to meet. And it just doesn't seem to me that's to say this man has, or any person involved here, has certain skills and they'll be able to, they'll be able to earn a living, they'll be able to distinguish themselves. That's just not enough of a rationale to forgive violation of the immigration laws with all the consequences that come from that.
So if Jose Antonio Vargas were to stay in the United States and to actually proceed on the road to citizenship, who would that be hurting?
Well, in any individual case, who knows? This is like to say, does any individual snowflake hurt anybody? Well, no individual snowflake is responsible for the avalanche. And it's hard. There's no way you can say this person, you can identify this person and do a news story on him, who was harmed by permitting its particular illegal immigrant to stay. Because the effects that illegal immigration has is more diffuse. It's on a whole variety of, whether it's taxpayers, whether it's students who can't get into, say, a community college because an illegal immigrant under the DREAM Act took that space. So the effects and the harm is very real.
What are some of your other concerns about the DREAM Act? You mentioned one. You think that only people who came here illegally when they were infants or very young children should qualify for the DREAM Act, people who didn't already have any identity as a native of their country. Other concerns?
Well, the other concerns stem from actually legalizing or amnestying the kind of people you're describing. In other words, even if we were to lower the age at which a person had to come here first to qualify, say to age 7, but even in that situation, this is still an amnesty. I mean, you have to be honest about it, and I'm for it under certain circumstances, but it is an amnesty, and amnesties have two important consequences. One is they encourage further illegal immigration by sending a message that if you keep your head down long enough, eventually you or your children or somebody will be able to get legal status. It serves as a kind of magnet for new illegal immigration. And the second effect that all amnesties have is that they reward people who broke the law. And so the two important things that any DREAM Act 2.0 would have to deal with would be these questions. One, what kind of enforcement measures would you add to a bill like this? And then secondly, how do you make sure that none of the adults involved ever are able to benefit from this? In other words, by being allowed to stay legally somehow or another, being petitioned for a green card, that sort of thing. For instance, with regard to that problem, there's really two ways you can address it. One is you legalize the kids, but you don't give them green cards so that they could become citizenship. You give them some kind of long-term non-immigrant visa, it's called. In other words, like a temporary visa, but one that's renewable indefinitely as long as you stay out of trouble. That way, they wouldn't be able to petition for any relatives. The alternative is you change the whole chain migration system, the categories that we have now, so that you would reduce, sort of narrow the definition of relatives that you could actually petition, that anybody could petition. The whole point, though, is to minimize the downstream effects and the downstream rewards that the amnesty would create for adults who really were responsible for breaking the law.
Now, you describe your think tank, the Center for Immigration Studies, as a low immigration pro-enforcement think tank. What does that mean?
Well, it means that we think numbers overall, immigration numbers overall, should be reduced. Enforcement is part of that, but it's only part of it. People often focus just on illegal immigration, and illegal immigration is obviously a significant problem, but our take on it really is that a modern society has no need for any immigration. We don't actually need immigration. I mean, our land is settled. We're an industrialized, post-industrial society. And so the question is, we need to start, from our perspective, start at zero, like zero-based budgeting, and then say, are there groups of people whose admission is so compelling that we let them in despite the fact there's no need for this sort of thing? And not to give you the long spiel on it, but that would amount to husbands, wives, and little kids of U.S. citizens who've never been limited in the past, aren't ever going to be limited in the future. But that's a lot of people. That's 350,000, 400,000 people right there, handful of Einsteins, real Einsteins, and a modest number of real refugees who will really never have anywhere else to go.
But America is really a country of immigrants. It's a country based on immigration. My grandparents were immigrants. What about your family?
Sure, mine were too. I mean, I didn't even speak English until I went to kindergarten because my parents, even though they were born here, spoke Armenian to me and English to each other. I mean, yeah, a lot of us obviously have immigrant origin. But to say that America is a nation of immigrants is only partly true. We are partly a nation of immigrants, but a number of things have formed what we are. We're also a nation of settlers and pioneers. But, you know, we don't have covered wagons crossing the Great Plains anymore. And the idea that immigration, which was an important element of the second half of the 19th century in forming who we are as a country now, is somehow essential to our sort of sense of self indefinitely into the future, it just strikes me as anachronistic.
I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, here's a guy whose grandparents were immigrants, his family has benefited from all America has to offer, and now that he's American, he wants to shut the door to a lot of other people who are now in comparable positions.
There are, in fact, a lot of people in comparable positions to my grandparents and yours. But America is not in a comparable position. Well, the difference really is from 100 years ago is not really the immigrants. They're really not that different today from my grandparents and yours. What's different is our country. I mean, we have matured as a nation. We've become a middle-aged country, if you will, and I can say this having just turned 50 myself. We've outgrown mass immigration. It was an important part of our adolescence, just as settling the frontier was, but, you know, we've left it behind. An analogy I used in my book, actually my editor made me take it out, so I always bring it up every time I talk about it, is to donuts. When you're 11 years old, you eat all the donuts your parents will let you eat, and they're probably good for you at that point. When you're 50 years old, you can't eat donuts like that anymore. There's nothing wrong with the donuts. They're the same donuts, but your metabolism has changed, and our body politics metabolism has changed significantly, so that we need to now start looking at what's good for our grandchildren, not what was good for our grandparents.
I know your group is very concerned about immigration from Mexico, particularly illegal immigration from Mexico. I don't know if you saw the article in the New York Times this week that began by saying the extraordinary Mexican migration that delivered millions of illegal immigrants to the United States over the past 30 years has sputtered to a trickle, and research points to a surprising cause, unheralded changes in Mexico that have made staying home more attractive.
Yes, I did read that, and I think that's part of what's happening. There's Mexican fertility. In other words, the number of kids that the average woman has declined dramatically. It's about the same as it is for the United States now. Although when Mexicans come here, their birth rates go way, way up. We've reported on this in the past. But there's no question that changes in Mexico are part of why we see a smaller flow, at least for now. But it's also because of our economic problems, obviously, because of the violence in Mexico, making actually traveling here, especially through the northern part of the country, much more dangerous. And it's because of, frankly, it is because of better enforcement here that has led to people thinking twice about crossing the border, or has led some significant number of people to think about packing up and going home. So this New York Times story from this week focused, I think, on one part of what we're seeing, but just one part. I think they made a bigger deal out of that one development than it really warrants. I mean, my point here is that this problem is not gone away. It's not something that we're just going to outgrow quickly. We're going to have a significant pressure for immigration from Mexico for a long time in the future that we're going to have to respond to one way or another. And in a couple of years, when the economy picks up more, assuming we don't run into a real depression, you're going to see you look back at stories like this, and they're not going to age very well.
So do you think there should be a DREAM Act at all, or do you think that there should be a DREAM Act, but just a narrower version of it?
I can see an argument for a narrower DREAM Act that has various other things attached to it, like enforcement. Yes, I mean, I can't speak for my organization, but if I were in Congress, I conceivably would be able to vote for something like that, yes.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay. Well, happy to do it. Happy to do it. I always like your show.
Mark Kerkorian is the executive director of the Center for Immigration Studies. You'll find a link to their website on our website, freshair.npr.org. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of the new documentary Project NIMH, directed by James Marsh, who made Man on Wire. NIMH tells the story of what happened to a chimp raised by humans and taught to communicate.
In the early 1970s, Columbia psychology professor Herbert Terrace speculated that if a chimpanzee were raised like a human child in a human home and taught sign language, because chimps don't have the physiological apparatus for human speech, then a door would open up to the animal mind. We'd learn what animals think and feel, perhaps even what they dream. I wouldn't be surprised if he envisioned a best-selling chimp pen novel, or at least a review of a Tarzan movie. Director James Marsh recounts Terrace's high hopes and where they led in his brilliant documentary Project Nim. It turns out what happened to Terrace's chimp subject, Nim, also known as Nim Chimpsky, was the stuff of nightmares, or a sick farce. From the start, when we hear how Nim is plucked from his shrieking mother's arms at a research facility, he's more to us than a project. He has complicated thoughts and emotions. He's practically human. No, hold on, he's not. And that's a problem, too. What people in the film project on this project says more about them than it does about poor, confused Nim. Get this. His first human mother, Stephanie Lafarge, a former student and lover of Terrace's, breastfed Nim, let him puff on a joint, and encouraged his PG-13 explorations of her body as he began puberty. She also worried, as hippie types tended to do, that Nim's developing language would constrain his animal nature, an idea that made me slap my forehead, as that's the whole point of the experiment. Nim was actually learning to sign, but there wasn't a lot of formal, organized research going on. So Terrace brought in a nice, pretty grad student who bonded with Nim and eventually became his full-time caretaker, and they left the Lafarges for a roomy Riverdale house owned by Columbia. But that student ended up sleeping with Terrace and then fleeing the project, and Nim had to bond with another woman, this time nearly biting off half her face and causing her to flee. Nim did, however, frantically sign, "I'm sorry," as she bled. After that, Nim was lucky enough to get researcher Bob Ingersoll, an enthusiastic Grateful Deadhead who stuck around.
Chimps aren't humans. You have to kind of understand chimps to be able to understand how to work with them and be with them. I took them out on walks. I didn't bring food. I didn't do the kind of things that would interrupt the relationship or the building of the relationship. He grows on you quick. He was so charming. I mean, it didn't occur to me that animals had that kind of personality like ours.
As he proved in Man on Wire, Marsh can stylize his documentaries in ways that only intensify the raw emotions. Project Nim is an artful weave of interviews and reenactments and lots of period footage, because much of what surrounded Nim was deemed momentous. He was even on the cover in 1975 of New York Magazine under the headline, "First Message from the Planet of the Apes." Each interview subject sits in a chair and recalls his or her interactions with Nim. And then, when they speak of leaving Nim's life, the camera travels away from them, often in a way that breaks your heart. In the second half of Project Nim, Terrace recalls his disappointment when he realized that Nim wasn't going to be the Noam Chomsky of chimps and lost interest, despite the fact that Nim had learned 125 signs. He didn't spend time playing with Nim. He didn't see the Nim that Bob Ingersoll saw.
I didn't care about the language argument after a while. It didn't matter to me. He might not have had sentences or grammar, but there's no question that there was communication going on, and I saw it clearly. He talked about the trees, the berries that he found. He liked to play. Favorite song, play.
Terrace lost his funding along with his interest, and the odyssey that follows the end of the experiment is devastatingly sad. While it's tempting to label Herb Terrace the villain in Project Nim, no one in this sorry saga is totally bad or good. Terrace was right. Nim opened a door, but into the human, not animal mind, and we can be a crazy species.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. WHYY's chief content officer is Christine Dempsey. I'm Terry Gross.